The Reluctant Dragon by Kenneth Graham, Part 7.
"Think you're gonna cut his head off, master?" asked one of the applauding crowd.
He had backed the dragon and naturally felt a trifle sore.
"Well, not today, I think," replied St. George pleasantly. "You see, that can be done at any time. There's no hurry at all. I think we'll all go down to the village first and have some refreshment, and then I'll give him a good talking to, and you'll find he'll be a very different dragon."
At that magic word, refreshment, the whole crowd formed up in a procession and silently awaited the signal to start. The time for talking and cheering and betting was past. The hour for action had arrived. St. George, hauling on his spear with both hands, released the dragon, who rose and shook himself and ran his eye over his spikes and scales and things to see that they were all in order. Then the saint mounted and led off the procession, the dragon following meekly in the company of the boy, while the thirsty spectators kept at a respectable interval behind. There were great doings when they had got down to the village again and had formed up in front of the inn. After refreshment, St. George made a speech in which he informed his audience that he had removed their direful scourge at a great deal of trouble and inconvenience to himself, and now they weren't to go about grumbling and fancying they'd got grievances, because they hadn't. They shouldn't be so fond of fights, because next time they might have to do the fighting themselves, which would not be the same thing at all. And there was a certain badger in the inn stables which had got to be released at once, and he'd come and see it done himself. Then he told them that the dragon had been thinking over things, and saw that there were two sides to every question, and he wasn't going to do it any more, and if they were good, perhaps he'd stay and settle down there. So they must make friends, and not be prejudiced and go about fancying they knew everything there was to be known, because they didn't, not by a long way. And he warned them against the sin of romancing, and making up stories, and fancying other people would believe them, just because they were plausible and highly colored. Then he sat down, amidst much repentant cheering, and the dragon nudged the boy in the ribs, and whispered that he couldn't have done it better himself. Then everyone went off to get ready for the banquet. Banquets are always pleasant things, consisting mostly, as they do, of eating and drinking. But the specially nice thing about a banquet is that it comes when something's over, and there's nothing more to worry about, and tomorrow seems a long way off. St. George was happy because there had been a fight, and he hadn't had to kill anybody, for he didn't really like killing, though he generally had to do it. The dragon was happy because there had been a fight, and so far from being hurt in it, he had won popularity and a sure footing in society. The boy was happy because there had been a fight, and in spite of it, his two friends were still on the best of terms. And all the others were happy because there had been a fight, and, oh, well, they didn't require any other reason for their happiness. The dragon exerted himself to say the right thing to everybody and prove the life and soul of the evening, while the saint and the boy, as they looked on, felt that they were only assisting at a feast in which the honor and the glory were entirely the dragon's. But they didn't mind that, being good fellows, and the dragon was not in the least proud or forgetful. On the contrary, every 10 minutes or so he leant over toward the boy and said impressively, "Look here, you will see me home afterwards, won't you?" And the boy always nodded, though he had promised his mother not to be out late. At last the banquet was over. The guests had dropped away with many good nights and congratulations and invitations, and the dragon, who'd seen the last of them off the premises, emerged into the street, followed by the boy, wiped his brow, sighed, sat down in the road, and gazed at the stars. "Jolly night it's been," he murmured. "Jolly stars. Jolly little place, this. Think I shall just stop here. Don't feel like climbing up any beastly hill. Boy's promised to see me home. Boy had better do it, then. No responsibility on my part. Responsibility all boys. and his chin sank on his broad chest, and he slumbered peacefully.
"Oh, get up, dragon!" cried the boy piteously. "You knew my mother sitting up, and I'm so tired, and you made me promise to see you home, and I never knew what it meant, or I wouldn't have done it." And the boy sat down on the road by the side of the sleeping dragon and cried.
The door behind them opened. A stream of light illumined the road, and St. George, who'd come out for a stroll in the cool night air, caught sight of the two figures sitting there, the great motionless dragon and the tearful little boy.
"What's the matter, boy?" he inquired kindly, stepping to his side.
"Oh, this great lumbering pig of a dragon," sobbed the boy.
"First he made me promise to see him home, and then he says I'd better do it, and he goes to sleep. Might as well try to see a haystack home. And I'm so tired, and mother's—" Here he broke down again.
"Now don't take on," said St. George. "I'll stand by you, and we'll both see him home."
"Wake up, dragon," he said sharply, shaking the beast by the elbow. The dragon looked up sleepily.
"What a night, George," he murmured. "What a—"
"Now look here, dragon," said the saint firmly. "Here's this little fellow waiting to see you home, and you know he ought to have been in bed these 2 hours, and what his mother'll say, I don't know, and anybody but a selfish pig would have made him go to bed long ago."
"And he shall go to bed," cried the dragon, starting up. "Poor little chap, only fancy his being up at this hour. It's a shame, that's what it is, and I don't think, St. George, you've been very considerate. But come along at once, and don't let us have any more arguing or shilly-shallying. You give me hold on your hand, boy. Thank you. George, an arm up the hill is just what I wanted." So they set off up the hill arm in arm, the saint, the dragon, and the boy. The lights in the little village began to go out, but there were stars and a late moon as they climbed to the downs together. And as they turned the last corner and disappeared from view, snatches of an old song were borne back on the night breeze. I can't be certain which of them was singing, but I think it was the dragon.
"Here we are at your gate," said the man abruptly, laying his hand on it. "Good night. Cut along and sharp, or you'll catch it."
Could it really be our own gate?
Yes, there it was, sure enough, with the familiar marks on its bottom bar made by our feet when we swung on it.
"Oh, but wait a minute," cried Charlotte. "I want to know a heap of things. Did the dragon really settle down, and did—"
"There isn't any more to that story," said the man kindly, but firmly. "At least not tonight. Now be off. Goodbye."
"Wonder if it's all true," said Charlotte, as we hurried up the path. "Sounded dreadfully like nonsense in parts."
"Perhaps it's true for all that," I replied encouragingly. Charlotte bolted in like a rabbit out of the cold and the dark, but I lingered a moment in the still frosty air for a backward glance at the silent white world without, ere I changed it for the land of firelight and cushions and laughter. It was the day for choir practice, and carol time was at hand, and a belated member was passing homewards down the road, singing as he went.
"Then St. George he made reverence in the stable so dim, or vanquished the dragon so fearful and grim, so grim and so fierce that now, may we say, all peaceful is our waking on Christmas Day."
The singer receded, the carol died away, but I wondered with my hand on the door-latch whether that was the song, or something like it, that the dragon sang as he toddled contentedly up the hill.